From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Well, good Friday afternoon to you. I am Sarah Perry, your host on this, the 10th of July, 2020. On today's edition of Washington Watch, the 2021 State Foreign Operations and Related Programs Appropriations Bill was reported out of the committee yesterday, and in an unsurprising turn of events, House Dems made sure to remove longstanding pro-life protections from the bill and took the hearing as an opportunity to grandstand on the international right to abortion. I've got Representative Andy Harris from my home state of Maryland with his thoughts and some audio from the hearing. In my second block, we talked yesterday with FRC's Ken Blackwell, who made a political comparison between the Democratic and Republican Party platforms of 2020. Today, David Claussen, our Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview, will join me to continue the discussion and offer his thoughts for Christian voters during this election season. Voters this year are faced with perhaps the most liberal Democratic platform of all time. At the bottom of the hour, I've got Mark Hemingway, senior writer for Real Clear Investigations, who joins me to discuss an open letter in Harper's Magazine from liberal elites on cancel culture, which, as irony would have it, resulted in that very same cancel culture pressuring some of the signers to distance themselves after the fact. And in my last block, I'll have Bob Fu, formerly of China Aid and FRC's newly minted senior fellow for international religious freedom, on China's obliteration of freedom in Hong Kong while the world turns a blind eye. I'll also have Roshan Abbas, executive director for Campaign for the Uyghurs, who'll talk U.S. sanctions on Chinese officials that forced the sterilization of Uyghurs within Chinese borders. A reminder for those of you who listen to the podcast, it's TonyPerkins.com for more information on today's program and resources that will prove helpful in your analysis of some of these issues and discussions. If you haven't already, download our Stand Firm app. It is available in the Apple and Google Play stores. And if you've already downloaded, make sure to update it. We've rebuilt it, and you can be sure to take Washington Watch with you wherever you go.
I rise in support of the gentleman's amendment. I can't agree to reverse the important policies put forth by this administration to protect life.
Well, that was Kate Granger from Texas, who is speaking on the appropriations bill on state foreign operations and related programs, or the SFOPS, for those of you who are government wonks or acronym followers. The Dems are omitting the Mexico City policy, which prohibits U.S. funding for foreign organizations that perform or actively promote abortion, taking it out of this House Appropriations bill, and it's apparently insufficient that the American abortion lobby is booming. Dems want to also facilitate the funding and expansion of abortion outside America as well. Joining me now to talk about this is Representative Andy Harris, who serves the 1st Congressional District of Maryland. Harris also serves as a doctor for 3 decades and is a member of the House Appropriations Committee. Congressman Harris, welcome back to the program.
It's good to be with you, Sarah.
Well, we started with some good audio from Kay Granger, but let's contrast that a bit and start with some of the comments from the House Dems. First up is Representative Barbara Lee of California, followed by Representative Lois Frankel of Florida. Let's listen.
It's mind-boggling to believe that this assault on women continues. This amendment, rather than recognize the sanctity of life, of women's life and children's life, it says to women that her and her family's life, they really don't matter.
My. The attacks by my friends on the other side of the aisle on women's health never seems to end. It's not bad enough that the Republicans have defunded parenthood here in America, but now it seems you will go to the end of the earth to prevent women from having full access to reproductive care.
You know, it sounded for a minute like Representative Frankel was going to say defunded Planned Parenthood, to which I say huzzah, but in fact she says defunded parenthood. I have to tell you, somebody who is sitting in, who is on that committee, Representative, do you find that the Democrats are a tad unhinged about this policy?
Well, in this debate, they certainly were. Look, this is not about women. This is not about contraception. This is not about reproductive rights. This is about abortion. And it's about forcing American taxpayers to pay for abortion overseas. You know, the UNFPA, which supported the horrendous one-child forced abortion policy in China for years, just needs to be defunded. If this is about women's choice, how could they possibly support an organization that forced Chinese women to have abortions?
It's unconscionable to us. We've seen this particular protection. This is an administration that made no bones about the fact that they were interested from the very outset in protecting life overseas. And I've got to tell you, as somebody who understands this, who is a member of this committee, this is not something that I think the average voter would anticipate the American taxpayer has to pay for. It's bad enough that we've had to work tooth and nail to divest public funds from organizations like Planned Parenthood, but to have to work as hard as we have to divest those funds from overseas NGOs, it really boggles the mind as far as I'm concerned.
That's right. You know, the fact of the matter, this is the foreign aid bill, and Americans are very skeptical of foreign aid in general. And if you tell Americans that you're going to spend their hard-earned taxpayer dollars funding abortions overseas, you know, a majority of them would say, no, keep my taxpayer dollars here. That's crazy. And then for the Democrats to use the term sanctity of life to defend abortion is again, this is Orwellian.
You know, a lot of people find these APROPES bills to be rather dry conversation makers. So we know, understanding that the government has to be funded continually and there are different committees that have to pass different APROPES bills. This is a particular issue of relevance because it has come up so many times in the democratically controlled House, and Nancy Pelosi is continuously at odds with an administration that makes sure to prioritize the sanctity of life, religious freedom, and the interests of the American taxpayer. In fact, we've got a clip from Representative Roger Atterholt from Alabama, who references that precise administrative commitment. Let's listen.
President Trump has made his intentions very clear. I think his quote was, "I will vote against any legislation that weakens current pro-life federal policies and laws or that encourage the destruction of innocent human life at any stage," end quote.
Well, I got to tell you, as we go into an election year, we understand what's at stake. We've been talking a lot about party platform comparisons and what these particular candidates look like. Do you believe that Pelosi's taken into account the fact that any pro-life legislation will ultimately be passed by the Senate, or any pro-abortion legislation will be shot down by the Senate, in making sort of strategic decisions about what she's going to encourage the lobby to do?
Well, certainly by these pro-abortion provisions getting into the appropriations bills, it guarantees that we will not have appropriations bills signed by the president before the election, because mm-hmm. the president meant what he said. He has put in writing that he will, in fact, veto any appropriations bill that attempts to change the pro-life policies that are put in place currently.
We have a summary of some of the accomplishments of the Trump administration. For those of you who are listening, frcaction.org/accomplishments is a summary of what the Trump administration has been able to accomplish for faith, family, and freedom since he's taken office. And Mexico City policy, I think many of us cheered initially because we recognized automatically with the reinstatement that this president was not playing around, particularly as it came to these issues. You know, there were some other individuals who spoke out who were, I would classify as equally unhinged. Were there any surprises in yesterday's hearing?
Well, again, you know, the surprise is that the Democrats defend the use of taxpayer dollars to fund overseas abortions, and again, couching this as the rights of women, or choice or contraception. This is not. This is about abortion. And in particular, we discussed the UNFPA, which, of course, funds International Planned Parenthood Foundation as well. Mm-hmm. So this is all about abortion. It's about international abortion. And again, this is something the president has fought since the day he took office. He is clearly the most pro-life president we've ever had. And he meant what he said.
You know, it's something to be aware of, again, for our listeners who are in the process. We'll talk about this in the next segment of comparing these party platforms and going to the ballot booths these next few months in both primaries and general elections, that this issue is fundamentally important, not just to the members of, for example, states like ours, where you represent the first congressional district and have been a staunch advocate for the issue of life, but the administration overall really has been able to facilitate these types of changes, has been able to pass the legislation that's come to his desk on these particular issues. Do you anticipate that there will be any additional shakeups as far as appropriations are concerned before the actual end of this election season?
No, there will be attempts. Next week, we consider the HHS, the health appropriations bill, and there are going to be attempts there as well to change some of the pro-life positions in that bill. But they will not. None of that will come to fruition because, again, the president is adamant. He has said he's going to veto anything that attempts to change the pro-life positions we have put in the appropriations bills while the Republicans were in control. And again, it also points out how important this election is because we do need one or two more pro-life judges on the Supreme Court because I do believe that at one point Roe v. Wade will be overturned.
Yes, amen to that. And this, again, for so many of us, the appointment of conservative, originalist, textualist justices, not only at the Supreme Court, but in the many federal judiciary positions that President Trump made good on his promises for, was a critical point for many of us who were rather undecided because he was an unknown political commodity going into the election one term ago. But again, it does go to the nature of what he's been able to accomplish and making good on those promises. So for the individuals who are listening to us, because again, we're picking up steam, we're seeing sort of the hoofbeats of the ongoing election hysteria. What do you want the voters to know who are listening about the commitment to the pro-life issue, not only on your behalf, but also on the behalf of this administration, and what's ultimately at stake in this election?
Well, the pro-life issue is completely at stake in this election because you couldn't have two more divergent opinions on the life issue than President Trump and his position and, former Vice President Biden and his position. This will be an exceedingly important election for voters for whom this is an important issue. This is a very, very clear choice.
Representative Andy Harris from the great state of Maryland, who shares the home state with me and also the same perspective that every life is to be valued beginning at conception. Thanks for all the good work that you do. We'll be watching closely to see if that good result is ultimately achieved in the Senate. Well, coming up in light of the upcoming presidential election, we're going to continue our discussion on a comparison between the Republican and Democratic Party platforms with FRC's Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview, David Claussen. He'll share his thoughts on Washington Watch coming up next.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain. and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Absent fathers, distracted fathers, and angry fathers have created a vacuum of the soul in the lives of many children. Pornography is epidemic, affecting the male brain, isolating his heart, and degrading women who long to be cherished. Confusion and even skepticism about marriage run rampant, especially in our younger generations. Selfishness among men has led to broken homes and a trail littered with broken hearts, including their own. Where can you turn to find the solutions to these problems? Leadership and Love, A Tale of Two Fathers, is a new publication from Family Research Council that takes a look at two men, Joshua and the father of the prodigal son, as strong examples of leadership and love. It also weaves in an understanding of attachment science to underscore the needs of children, which need to be met to become emotionally healthy and spiritually strong. Visit frc.org/fathers to learn more.
In today's culture, it can be difficult for men to navigate what it means to be a man and to find clear models of masculinity and manhood. There are many competing ideas out there and even confusion around the basic concepts of gender and sex. Where can boys, young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of manhood, leadership, and strength in today's culture of confusion? This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join me at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference led by men who are seasoned, compassionate leaders who understand the issues of the day. These issues will invest in unpacking our role as defenders, providers, instructors, and battle buddies so that men can have generational influence as a chaplain inside and outside the home. Join us at one of our upcoming events in Texas, Louisiana, Florida, or Virginia. Learn more about Stand Courageous and find an event near you at StandCourageous.com. That's StandCourageous.com. StandCourageous.com.
Well, welcome back to Washington Watch on this Friday, the 10th of July, 2020. We're continuing our discussion on party platform comparison, and never has there been more a distinct difference between the blue and red platforms than perhaps this year, when you have someone like Socialist Senator of Vermont Bernie Sanders on MSNBC saying that if Biden's recommendations in a unity task force document are adopted, he will be, quote, the most progressive president since FDR. You really need to open your eyes and consider what's going on around you. So here to talk to me, not just about the party platform, but also what particular issues are at stake for those individuals with a Christian worldview, is our director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview, David Clausen. David, welcome back.
Hey, great to be with you again, Sarah.
All right, so let's give sort of a high-level perspective here. There was a 110-page document that was submitted. It is a Biden-Sanders Unity Task Force recommendation list, combating the climate crisis and pursuing environmental justice, because that's right now what we're most worried about, right?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, no, absolutely. This is an important document, Sarah, this task force, this unity document that was put together by allies and surrogates for both Senator Sanders and former Vice President Joe Biden. Kind of they're trying to bring, you know, the Democrat Party together, trying to coalesce around a set of shared values. But when you see this document, you see the names that are on it. It's what you would expect when you see a document with Eric Holder, John Kerry, AOC. But it really is a liberal wish list. And I'll say this, you know, it really should dispel once and for all this notion that Joe Biden is moderate. Because, again, this is just a grab bag of a liberal wish list that would make Barack Obama look conservative.
So give us some of those highlights. What are some of the most egregious of these recommendations? And there are plenty to choose from.
No, there really are. So whether it's demanding that the minimum wage is raised, saying that they're going to raise taxes on the wealthy, abolish right to work, calling for a roadmap to citizenship for all illegal aliens, supporting, you know, saying that they want to make community college free, including for illegal immigrants, calling for a new jobs program in line with the New Deal. All of these things are just going to make the government just bigger. But for Christians and social conservatives, there's a line on here, and I'll just read it straight from the document. This
Please.
Is what they're calling for. It says, the task force will restore federal funding for Planned Parenthood. And then you drop down a line or two, and it says, Democrats oppose and will fight to overturn federal and state laws that create barriers to women reproductive rights, including repealing the Hyde Amendment, and will work to protect and codify Roe v. Wade. And so Christians, social conservatives, you know, they are telling us exactly what they will do if they win in November, which is an assault on the pro-family, pro-life values that Christians care so deeply about, that they are telling us exactly where they are going with this, and we have to be paying attention.
For those of us who are listening, who are interested in party platform comparisons, FRC's got some great resources. So go to TonyPerkins.com. We've got videos uploaded. We've got an actual document that compares side by side some of these big issues that you ought to be aware of, listeners, as you go into the voting booths this fall. And these Unity Task Force recommendations, they are ultimately a gift to us. And I say that because they are the recommendations of the presumptive Democratic nominee. So we know that despite what Kanye West has announced on Twitter, and the fact that it is too late for him in most elective states where he could actually get on the ballot, this is who we're looking at. It's a two-person race. It is one candidate from the GOP, Donald Trump, and one candidate from the Democrats, Joe Biden. And regardless of the fact that people have attempted to present him as a moderate, his statements have gone further and further to the left, even calling the trans civil rights struggle, transgender, the civil rights issue of our time. Well, I would highly disagree with that. If you're talking 0.1%, I'm certainly not going to consider that when I go to the voting booth. I would much rather make sure that we can put food on the table, that my pro-life interests are protected, that my religious liberty is protected. And we've seen in Donald Trump a president that understands and has a respect, a gravitas for the Constitution and for our founding fathers. Is that something we ought to take into account as we go to the voting booths?
Oh, it absolutely is, Sarah. I think that's just a phenomenal point that you made. You know, I was having a great conversation last night with my parents, actually, about the election. And, you know, my dad was reminding me he's having these conversations with people in his church. You know, some people are saying, well, I disagree with someone's personality. And, you know, the point is, you know, we're always going to disagree with, you know, someone's personality or whatnot, but it's the policies. It's the positions that are outlined in the party platform that matter such a great deal. Because, and I've said this with you on the show, Sarah, you know, 80% of the time politicians, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, govern in line with the party platform. And just look at the 2016 platform in the Democrats' platform when they were nominating Hillary Clinton. I have the platform in front of me. It says LGBT rights are human rights. They said back in 2016, abortion must be part of comprehensive maternal and women's health care. Joe Biden wants to do that and take it even more extreme. He's actually campaigning on the Equality Act, saying that that will be his top legislative accomplishment. And like you said, he's also campaigning on allowing convicted criminals who are men but identify as women to have access to women's prisons. So again, these are the concrete policy things that are being advanced that we absolutely need to be aware of.
You know, and it's great that you talk about that, because there have been some discussions about whether or not Trump can secure the suburban female vote, that's sort of a demographic that he hasn't always played well with. I see in this situation an opportunity for Trump to get votes when women understand that the protections, their legal status in federally recognized law, is actually in the chopping block. David Claussen's been my guest. We're going to talk cancel culture. Cancel culture, the theme of this year, and even some on the left have actually had enough of it. We'll talk to senior writer for Real Clear Investigations, Mark Hemingway, about it right after this on Washington Watch. We'll be right back.
Christians have a biblical obligation to participate in government? Do Christians have a duty to vote? And if so, what principles should inform them while casting their ballots? How should pastors think about politics, and how can they shepherd their congregations well during an election season? The gospel of Jesus Christ has implications for all areas of our life, including politics. Christians must be prepared to grapple with the moral issues of our day, the reality of our two-party system, and follow our Christian convictions to their logical end by voting for candidates that support clear biblical values. Family Research Council has partnered with 21 state family policy councils for a new edition of Biblical Principles for Political Engagement. This booklet provides biblical wisdom and clear answers to pivotal questions to help you navigate the political landscape. This publication exists to facilitate careful thinking about issues and encourage God-honoring political engagement that filters all issues and candidates through a biblical worldview. To read the full publication, visit frc.org/engage.
Not so long ago, sex education in public schools involved learning about human growth and development and listening to advice on how to be careful, respect others, and save sex for marriage. Things are very different today. Parents have two main concerns about sex ed: that it sexualizes children and that it's loaded with LGBTQ indoctrination. Family Research Council has released a new resource to address this issue titled Sex Education in Public Schools: Sexualization of Children and LGBT Indoctrination. This resource reveals troubling examples of the agenda-driven content being pushed in modern sex ed and exposes the powerful organizations behind it all. Finally, it offers some action steps for parents to consider in their fight to protect the health and innocence of their children. For more information about sex education in public schools and to view this resource, visit frc.org/sexeducation. That's frc.org/sexeducation.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday, July 10th, 2020. Well, in a list of 150 elites who penned an open letter in Harper's Magazine, some in academia and media signed on to a reasonable letter on justice and open debate, basically calling out cancel culture. It was just published Tuesday in Harper's. The signatories' politics wildly vary. So we've got Noam Chomsky, David Frum, to Margaret Atwood and J.K. Rowling. They share the same membership, educated elites. They are the intelligentsia of America. But at least there is a positive development. Some are willing to call it out, even on the left end of the political spectrum, until the backlash began. So joining me now to discuss it and the fragility of the woke is senior writer for Real Clear Investigations, Mark Hemingway. Mark, welcome back.
Glad to be back.
So let's talk about how this started. So Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling, apparently rich enough and powerful and popular enough to be able to say that truth is truth. She was smeared as transphobic on Twitter when a tax researcher was fired for saying identifying as a woman does not make a person a woman. Rowling tweeted, "I agree. Is this real?" And the rest, as they say, is history. So now here we are with this open letter, and even some of the signers have been pilloried on Twitter. And so in a great turn of irony, we have those writing on cancel culture actually being canceled by cancel culture. Is this sort of the latest turn of intelligentsia's commitment to waning common sense in an effort to maintain their visibility?
Yes. I think that's true. But I would point out that this is not, you know, a late breaking anything. I mean, this has been going on for quite some time. And in fact, you know, it's true that trans issues are like a hot button issue here. And, you know, certainly J.K. Rowling made this an issue in the days leading into this. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, this was an issue that started long before trans issues. And if anything, if they're taking a basic free speech concern and constantly trying to make it about trans issues to, like, form it as a wedge, you know, on against everything else. And I think a lot of people in this community that, you know, kind of care about free speech are getting sort of frustrated about it. Like, why does everything have to be about trans issues?
Right, right. And why is speech considered violence? I'm sorry, violence is violence. Action is actually violence. Speech is not violence. I want to talk about where this comes from, because what I see in the pictures of the riots and the toppling of statues are sort of an angry dissident group of well-to-do post-millennials in their early to mid-20s with too much time on their hands. So do we lay the blame at the feet of academia?
I mean, I think that's obviously true, that certain ideas have taken hold within the academic institution, such as, you know, critical theory and critical race theory, these sort of neo-Marxian arguments that are premised on, you know, sort of logical closed loops that are more cultish than they are, you know, than they are encouraging open discourse. And this is something that, like, had been building in the academy for some time. And I think just in the last 20 or 30 years, it reached critical mass such that people that went, a certain subset of people that went to college, you know, were trained specifically to be activists. I mean, this was actually the point of a lot of this sort of critical theory stuff, was that you were, you know, the point of education was to rectify injustice and to create activists, not to impart knowledge. And I definitely think that that has taken hold among younger people that haven't really even, frankly, been that well educated on competing ideas, you know, regarding, you know, basic things like free speech or free enterprise. And that's a problem. I mean, they've been taught that, you know, one set of ideas and one set of ideas only is correct. Mm-hmm. They haven't been given a classical liberal idea of, you know, competing ideas.
Well, this is, just as you said, it's ultimately illiberalism. And if we know anything about the hard left, is that it's regressive and it's cannibalistic. So are we going to anticipate an ultimate reckoning? What's the natural extermination of some kind of a movement like this? Where are we headed?
Well, that is a really good question. I think a lot of people are asking that. You know, first, I mean, I think that what we need to do is we need to, like, completely reassess education in this country. Now, it's mm-hmm. obvious that, you know, public universities and public schools aren't going away anytime tomorrow. But I think that, you know, people who care about their kids learning some basic ideas that, you know, have made Western civilization prosper, such as belief in absolute and transcendent truths, belief that, you know, the way to be prosperous and happy is to, you know, engage in the free exchange of ideas and goods with people that disagree with you.
Yes.
And I think if you can inculcate that in a future generation, or at the very least, you know, create enough of a, you know, sizable group of people that exist outside of this current sort of, you know, dominant thinking in educational institutions, in 10 or 20 years, and you might have something. I mean, I think that there, the homeschooling movement, places like Hillsdale College in Michigan and other places, I think are starting to be a vanguard of that. And increasingly, I think you're starting to see parents and, you know, cultural institutions, certain churches, things like that, you know, learn that they need to step aside.
Boy, I wish we could go on talking about this, because as a parent, I can't help but think this is what happens when you give a kid a trophy for everything. A lot of notions of personal safety, when in fact, disparate ideas and open discourse are good things for the development of the mind and the securing of America. Well, coming up, China continues to tighten its grip on Hong Kong. The hope of freedom is fading for many of the Hong Kong Chinese. And we'll talk to FRC's newly minted senior fellow for international religious freedom, Bob Fu, about it right after this on Washington Watch. Could you use some timely and original commentary to read this summer, specifically on the issues facing our culture today? FRCblog.com has just what you're looking for. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts, members of the Family Research Council team, as well as outside contributors. You can learn about religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture. Check out this list of a few of our most recent titles. What Does It Mean to Be a Woman? DC Christians Take to the Streets to Sing, Lament, and Pray, and prayerfully responding to civil unrest. At Family Research Council, our mission is to advance faith, family, and freedom in the culture by helping you to live out your faith and stand for truth. Our blog helps you do just that. Stay informed and get the resources you need at frcblog.com. On April 16th, President Trump and the White House Coronavirus Task Force announced a three-phase plan with guidelines for how states can begin scaling back restrictions. Churches should begin putting in place plans to reopen and operate their ministries according to the guidance of the Centers for Disease Control as state officials begin lifting orders. Here at Family Research Council, we have summarized the White House three-phase plan and how it relates to in-person church meetings and gatherings. Check out our resource, What Pastors Should Know About the White House Plan to Open Up America Again. Our resource offers practical guidelines for how churches and houses of worship can begin to operate safely as our country reopens. Visit frc.org/church guidelines to view this resource and learn more. There, you'll also find our full list of resources for churches in the time of coronavirus. Again, that's frc.org/church guidelines.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Hannah.
What's going on? Why so gloomy?
Well, I'm a little disappointed. I had a lot planned to do during the stay-at-home time, and I just didn't do it.
Oh, yeah? What did you have planned that you didn't get to do?
Well, I was actually hoping I would finally be able to get time to do a regular Bible reading routine, and I started a couple of times. I just didn't stick with it.
Don't be too down on yourself. Starting a new routine can be hard, but one way to help is to join in with others and to have a good game plan. I think I have a good solution for you.
Oh, yeah?
Tony Perkins and FRC are doing a 2-year study in the Word. They have it all mapped out.
When did they start? I would be so far behind.
Oh, that's not a problem. You can literally jump in anytime. There's a daily reading, just a couple of chapters a day, with questions to help you think about what you're reading.
Nice. Where can I find this?
Go to frc.org/Bible, and you can get started.
Where's that again?
frc.org/Bible.
Got it. Checking it out now.
Welcome back to Washington Watch, friends. It is Friday, the 10th of July. It's probably hot where you are, but I want to talk about a subject that we here at FRC are very passionate about, the notion of Hong Kong independence. And for someone like me who grew up watching the Tiananmen Square protests that ultimately became a massacre, I am particularly passionate about this topic. It was the first time I had seen people stand up to a government so big that the stakes to us seemed insurmountable. We've read about last year's pro-democracy protests, which captured global attention. They initially targeted a proposed extradition law. Remember, this would have allowed Hong Kong residents to be extradited to China and subjected to a corrupt judicial system. But this year's threat is worse. The Chinese National People's Congress is expected to ratify a new national security law for Hong Kong, and details indicate it will be worse. Joining me now to talk about it is FRC's new Senior Fellow for International Religious Freedom, Bob Fu. Bob, I'm so glad to welcome you as a new member of FRC.
Thank you for having me. It's really an honor for me.
So tell us what's going on with Hong Kong right now. We've seen footage of the millions in the streets thronging to protect their separateness, their autonomy and independence from China. But now we're hearing rumblings of a new security law. So tell us what's going on.
Yes, the new security law had already taken effect on July 1st, imposed directly by the Chinese National People's Congress and rubber stamped of Chinese Communist Party and President Xi Jinping. According to this new security law, those individuals and organizations who are deemed engaging the so-called secession, the terrorism, the so-called subversion of state power, or the collusion with foreign forces will be sentenced to minimum 3 years up to life in prison. So from July 1st, the so-called one country, two system is dead. The freedom of assembly is dead. The freedom of association is dead. The freedom of religion is deeply jeopardized in Hong Kong.
So what is with the world's blindness to the CCP's vast human rights violation? Obviously, we could not ignore millions taking to the streets to protest the extradition law. But suddenly it seems as if the world's attention has been geared toward other things. In fact, there's not only just a near blindness. In some instances, it's an actual protestation of doing anything other than siding with the CCP. We know the NBA, for example, gaining millions from its Chinese ventures, has an opportunity to speak out for Hong Kong and does not do it. So why is there a blindness when these are human rights that rise to such an atrocious level?
Well, this tells a very a rule of operation by this world. Money walks and money talks. So when these NBA players and stars and these American social elites, we were able to talk loud and really against the norms, the social so-called injustice items in U.S. domestic politics, they are really hypocritically silent and even in power and kowtowing to the Chinese Communist Party's bullying to the peaceful protesters and beating them up. And the youngest protesters who was arrested and still under prosecution is 12 years old. The oldest one is 82 years old, and over 2,000 already under prosecution more than 21,000 had been already arrested, and many thousands were even disappeared. So you talk about injustice. I mean, is this much worse? You know, injustice can you find in other parts of the world?
So let me ask you this. Is anyone that we know globally standing up for Hong Kong in the midst of this? And as a second part, what can we as American listeners do particularly for the region?
I think, as people of faith, as Christians, we certainly need to pray for them. We need to know their names, what's really happening. I mean, this new law is not only just threatening the basic liberties of Hong Kongese people, 7.6 million people, but also, according to the Article 38 of this law applies to anyone anywhere in the world. It said if anyone who is not a Hong Kongese, if deemed as offending or engaging these four categories of activities, like you and I are talking, we are going to be prosecuted. We're going to be, if we go to Hong Kong and even pass by the Chinese Communist Party, will arrest us for talking about this. And so this is really, I think, coming to our door. So we certainly need to ask our president and secretary of state, who have already taken some very encouraging initial steps by declaring Hong Kong one country, two systems is already dead, by declaring Hong Kong is already part of the Communist Party rule. So Hong Kong's preferral treatment as a world trade center with a separate treaty with the U.S. Is reconsidered, and many other countries, including Australia and Canada, already revoked their extradition treaties with Hong Kong. And, of course, their financial center, Communist Party had been used to take advantage of U.S. dollars and raising trillions of dollars, that also needs to be really addressed. I think from both the clear and also the public policy actions, we can do a lot to continue to pressure the Chinese Communist Party's brutal rule and also address the concerns.
One last question for you, Bob. Do we know anything about what the national atmosphere is among the Hong Kong Chinese as they're faced with the prospect of this new totalitarian law?
Yes, the sentiment are twofold. So, on the one hand, of course, it's sent a very chilling signal, not only a signal, the Communist Party already established a Bureau of State Security to enforce this national security law. Basically, any Hong Kong citizen or residents, including Americans, Britons who are living there, would subject for secret detention and kidnapping, forced in disappearance, or arbitrary sentence in criminal terms without any judicial review by the Hong Kong own court systems. Mm. So that is, of course, very scary. On the other hand, we have also seen some of the Hong Kong young kind of democracy leaders like Joshua Huang, you know, who is 21 years old, leader of the Umbrella Movement, who chose to even stay in Hong Kong, continue the fight, and even declare his candidacy for August, the Legislative Council election. And of course, you know, he's facing a very likely criminal prosecution arrest in the very near future.
Bob Fu's been my guest for this segment, but I've got to transition now to the U.S. sanctions being placed on Chinese officials. One of these good steps that Bob Fu was initially mentioning, in charge of the forced sterilization of the Uyghurs, these Chinese officials. So remember, the Uyghurs are minority Muslim population in the nation. This is part of a larger campaign against disparate religions, minority religions. The Chinese government has targeted Uyghurs, but I want to talk specifically about the steps the United States has encouragingly just taken. So joining me now to talk about it is the Executive Director of Campaign for the Uyghurs, Ruchan Abbas. Ruchan, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity.
So the Treasury Department just announced Thursday that the U.S. has sanctioned four Chinese Communist Party officials and the Xinjiang Public Security Bureau for human rights abuses against Uyghur Muslims and other ethnic minorities in Xinjiang. Do we know specifically what these individuals were doing?
Well, they are responsible for the blatant human rights abuses, which is the genocidal actions of the Chinese government. When you look at someone like Chen Chengguo, he's an example of how the Chinese regime is recycling those human rights abusers, human rights offenders, to implement new and sick ways of carrying out their genocidal crimes on everybody's, in front of everybody's eyes. So those sanctions are only a part of what these evil men deserve. And it's really encouraging for us to see how quickly U.S. government has moved since the Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act was signed into the law. For me, this is so personal, as my own sister, Dr. Michelle Abbas, a retired medical doctor, was taken by this genocidal regime, and she had been detained in the camp since 2018.
Ruchan, I'm going to put you on hold 1 second here and give our listeners a little bit of background here. These sanctions designations, okay, for those of you who are listening for whom we are confused by the notion of sanctioning individual bureaus or individuals, they are pursuant to the Global Magnitsky Act. I've always struggled with that one, passed by Congress in 2016. So this is really a significant escalation in the Trump administration's response to the Chinese government's detainment of over 1 million Uyghurs in internment camp. And if you'll remember, the history indicates that for many months, the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, was denying to the world that these detention camps exactly existed, and then were forced to do an about face and actually posited that they were education camps and showed very cleanly represented and highly propagandized pictures of individuals who were learning and who were receiving benefits from these particular camps. But Ruchan, you understand what these camps actually are. Talk a little bit about what these camps are.
The camps first used to brainwash people, indoctrinate people, and they according to former inmates, they are being used for torture and making people to forsake their religious identity, and forsake their ethnic identity. These people are subject to unknown medications, and recently we saw Dr. Adrian Zenz's release report, and they are basically destroying the Uyghur people's birth rate by basically using sterilization and medicines over there. So those camps are used to basically conduct genocide against Uyghur people. What's happening right now is not just as China claims, those are like vocational training centers or re-education centers. They are being used as slave laborers. The SP, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, they released a report called In the Name of Uyghurs for Sale. Imagine that, 21st century. The Uyghurs are basically being used as slaves. So that's why we are extremely happy with this first step forward. But these sanctioning these four officials is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what needs to be done to hold China accountable for this genocide. But this is a great start. And we really need other countries to follow, actually, because it's not just about the calamity of the Uyghurs right now. This is a test for humanity. This is a test for the conscience of the world.
It truly is. And as we talked to Bob Fu previously, China continues to be the elephant in the room of so many of these international human rights abuses. They insist, despite the connections to some of these other nations with their trade alliances, and there appear to be some alliances in which individuals who are leading their nations do not want to confront the CCP's policies, when in fact they are the author of so many of these particularly hideous policies. We're encouraged by the fact, I will say, that Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region's CCP Secretary Chen Guangguo is a member of the Politburo, which is the Chinese communist body that decides policy for the entire country. What an encouragement and what an interesting development that we know that the department has actually issued sanctions against one of the highest ranking individuals who develops policy for the entire country. So as you've said, Ruchan, this is a great start, but there's more to come, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. The Campaign for Uyghurs, we just released a report called Genocide in East Turkestan. And all of the information in the report is compiled so that the international community can see how each pieces, they have been ignored and even be complicit in, have led to meeting the definition of genocide by the United Nations Convention, the crimes of genocide.
Ruchan Abbas has been my guest in the second half of today's show on Washington Watch. For more information, TonyPerkins.com. Make sure you have that Stand Firm app on your phone so you can take us wherever you go. And until then, have a great weekend. We'll see you next week on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.